You're listening to Angophora Arts, a podcast about reading
and writing
for people who love books.
This episode was recorded on Gadigal and Bidjigal lands of the Eora Nation. Hello, book world, and welcome to the first episode of the Angophora Arts podcast. My name is Sarah Sasson. I'm a Sydney-based author, doctor, and researcher, and I'll be your host. Every week, we'll be chatting to local authors and other members of the literary community. So let's see who we'll be catching up with this week. Our guest author today is Al Campbell, a Brisbane-based mother, carer, and author of The Keepers, published by University of Queensland Press in 2022. Al and I first made contact in 2019 when she answered an open call out for a medical humanities collection I was editing called Signs of Life. Little did I know that our selected piece was actually an extract from her novel manuscript. The Keepers went on to be nominated for the Queensland Literary Awards Fiction Book Award and also the People's Choice Award. And in 2023, she was awarded a Queensland Writers Fellowship for the development of her second novel with the working title Door 64. Al's work has additionally appeared in Overland, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and The Guardian. Hello, Al Campbell. How are you?
Hello, Dr. Sarah. I am very well. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, welcome to what will be the very first podcast episode of Angophora Arts. We're so thrilled that you can be a part of its debut.
Thank you. I'm thrilled that you're having your own podcast. How exciting.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. How are things for you? So you're joining us from Brisbane today?
Yes, where it is pouring and has been for some time. So I actually have a cardigan on in Brisbane in November.
Yeah. Very unusual. Very unusual. Very, very. Okay. Well, you're happy there. It's conducive to writing.
It is indeed.
So let's have a little chat today about lots of things, but I wanted to talk first about your debut novel, The Keepers, which was released in 2022. So it followed the story of Jay, a woman caring for her twin sons, Teddy and Frank, who need her in all the usual maternal ways, but also have quite significant additional care needs. There's a captivating half-real harlequin named Keep, who in many ways is Jay's only emotional support. And there's also this looming specter of a chillingly abusive mother. What was your experience like as a debut novelist, and how did life change after The Keepers was released into the world?
Well, it was an adventure. I mean, you would know that. It's an adventure. And you just kind of wing it, I guess, don't you? So there's the good and there's the bad. The good is, I suppose, feeds into your question of how life changed. And I suppose the biggest change for me is that I met people. And it sounds a bit odd, but I really, you know, I didn't meet people, because when you're a carer, you know, which I have been for the past 20 plus years, you know, when you have people with special needs, you get into a routine and things need to be done every day. Some things need to be done every hour. Some things have to be done the same way every day, as we may well find out in a minute when my son decides he must come in here and do what he's got to do in here. So if we hear him, that's what that will be about. And being a sort of a person who's not a natural social butterfly anyway, I had very much let myself fall into that regimen of staying her indoors, you know. I was known as her indoors. And so when The Keepers came out, you know, obviously I met people. I met other writers. Yeah.
Yeah, mostly around Brisbane, or are you talking more online or Australia? Like where did you find most of the community?
No, it was actually funny. Brisbane was the last kind of people that I ended up connecting with, because the book just wasn't really in the shops here, wasn't known. Yeah, so that was one of the bad, I suppose, if we want to get into that, is like the day that it came out, or a couple of days after, I went to my local bookstores only to find them wasn't in there. But it had been, I think, picked up in shops in other parts of the country. And so people were contacting me and saying, I'm in the airport in Sydney and here's a copy. And you know, people, you know, sort of people like Nikki Gemmel, who'd been an early reader, you know, wrote about it in her column on the Saturday. And so people like that got behind it. So it was... was meeting people like that, and of course I'd already met you, you know, through, because you gave me my first publishing acceptance. So you really started it all, Dr. Sarah, and I sort of we've continued on together. And
Signs of Life anthology.
Yes, that's right. And
we had quite a few successes from that anthology. We had Sophie Overit with
Yes.
Your book and then eventually my book. And,
yes.
Yeah, so it's been exciting to watch. But it is that funny, I think it's a funny paradox of writing. As you say, you spend so long even without the caregiving needs, even just the process of writing is essentially so solitary and generally quite isolating. But then you put the book in the world and all of a sudden there are reasons to talk to other people or go to book events, launches. Yeah, but and I found that with Tidelines, but it's almost like you need a whole nother self. You need your writerly self, but then you need your sort of author promotion self as well. And they're quite different beasts.
They certainly are. So you know, the writer self is very much attached to your natural born introvert. And then the promotional stuff, you know, requires, and that was all right for me because, you know, I used to act for a living. So long as I know what I'm talking about, I don't have a problem getting out in front of people.
Experience. So following The Keepers, I know you got a couple of invitations to Writers Festival. So Brisbane Writers Festival and as well as Sydney Writers Festival. And at Brisbane, I couldn't be there, but I understand you're on a panel with Trent Dalton about love. Is that right?
That was interesting. Yes. So Trent and I and Kylie Scott, who writes, you know, romance and erotic fiction, poor Kylie stuck pinned between Trent on one end and me on the other. So we all had brought different perspectives to the topic of love, and it was a big crowd. Obviously, it was a sellout with Trent Dog there, and yeah, so that was interesting. Trent has his perspective, and Kylie had a different perspective, and then I suppose I was the Grinch on the panel, you know, because in fact, I think I remember when you read the manuscript of The Keepers, and you gave me very kindly lots of medical advice because there's a bit of hospital time in that book. You described it. In fact, I've got you. I wrote you words down. It was so lovely. There is a fierce, desperate love coursing throughout The Keepers. A love so ferocious it bears its teeth. But of course, in the book, the point of the book, or one of the points, is that in the end, you know, love sometimes isn't enough to save the day. So that was my sort of perspective, and you know, my perspective on love is as a carer and a mother and a caring mother, is sometimes love's just showing up. It's not particularly rosy, and you've got your head on backwards, and just being there and not opting out is love.
Yeah, and that comes through quite strongly in The Keepers, which we should unpack a little bit more, but really, Jay is sort of the sole carer for these two boys, within a medical and a sort of social support system that essentially doesn't make anything easy. And then throughout the book, there's also these scattered kind of, I can't remember how you bring them in. Is it through newspaper clippings? But you definitely eliminate, you know, some very high-profile stories about when things go tragically wrong in those scenarios. But the scenarios are, you know, when you have children with very high needs in a a governmental system that doesn't support them and a medical system which can alienate them. And you give these people essentially no support. And then, you know, people aren't coping. And then tragic things happen, whether it's abuse of the vulnerable child. And sometimes it's murder or manslaughter through neglect. Isn't that right? It's abuse. Yes. The most horrific kind. And you sort of, but it, yeah, it's very sensitively done because we see the book through Jay's eyes and she loves her children, but it's not an easy love, right? It's a love of daily, hourly service that comes at a great personal cost. And then it's sort of foiled by some of these stories in the news about, when people aren't able to cope as Jay is managing. And some of those stories, were they all true stories?
The ones? Look, sadly they were, yeah. And when I first wrote the book, I had fictionalized those stories because I was very concerned, you know, if somebody got the book out of a library, you know, 10 years time and opened it and, you know, that very first story of the boy in Sydney struck by the train who ran away from the weekend respite place, you know, what if that was a member of that boy's family? You know, I just wanted to avoid that. But my publisher, quite rightly, you know, suggested these are horror stories in themselves and they're in the public arena. And so long as we pay for their use through copyright, we have every right to use them. So we did. And, you know, as it says in, I think, the book club questions in the back of the novel, that in surveys conducted both here and around the world, the care and welfare of people with a disability routinely ranks last as the social issue of most concern to respondents. I dare say since 2022, that hasn't changed at all. And until that changes, you know, we're going to continue to have those horror stories. They still go on. I do post about them. There's very little response to that. So,
of course, Annabelle Crabb read your book, count her amongst your readers, and then invited you to be in conversation with her on the main stage of Sydney Writers Festival, where I was lucky enough to be in the audience. But during that conversation, you know, you gave some fairly sobering statistics about, particularly about the number and proportion of unpaid family caregivers and the amount of unacknowledged work. So what do you think it is about, it's not a small problem, but it's kind of an invisible one, and yet it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't seem to rank highly on anyone's.
No, it doesn't. It's not sexy. It doesn't make us look particularly, you know, glamorous to throw support behind the disabled.
I suspect some of your advocacy is now finding its way into your writing, and I mean, certainly they're in The Keepers, but I understand you've just completed novel number two. So I wanted to hear a little bit about book two and, yeah, if any of those themes make their way into it. What's the next novel about?
Yeah, I think I'll always be flying that flag. So while this is a very different novel and there's nothing of me or of us in it at all, it's actually inspired a true crime, an unsolved crime, Brisbane crime here in 1952, but I've just fictionalized it. And so I've introduced, and part of some characters in there that I've introduced a family where there's actually characters all around that have got, you know, they're just a bit different. They're just a bit marginalized for this reason or another.
What's the unsolved crime? What is it?
It's the murder of Betty Shanks in 1952. It was never solved. They never even had a suspect. So it's all inspired by that. And Betty herself she was a perfectly capable young girl. She was 22 when she was murdered. But she had a congenital spinal defect. And as a result, even though she was only 22, she sort of she walked like an old lady. She walked very, very, very slowly. And people didn't want to get stuck with her from the tram walking home, because if you got caught walking with Betty, you'd be late. You'd be later still. And so people used to sort of pretend they didn't see her and run off. And So she was walking alone that night and she was murdered.
So Betty, was she found indoors or outdoors? And I'm asking because I know that houses or a particular house is important in the news.
Yes. So she was sort of accosted on a footpath and thrown over the fence of a corner house in the suburb of the Grange, and this in 1952, and she was found the next morning. In the area where I used to walk past that house on my way to, obviously a couple of years after 1952, but I used to walk past that house on my way to and from school, and the lore, L-O-R-E, of that murder was still very much a presence as I was growing up. And so, you know, if one of my sisters was going to walk home from the dance, my mother would say things like, "Don't walk home on your own, you'll be the next Betty Shanks," that sort of thing. And so, I don't know, maybe people on the other side of town weren't as aware of it, but certainly it was, she was still a presence and her name was invoked as a sort of a caution, as though, you know, she'd somehow brought this thing down on her own ears just by walking home alone, as so happens.
You grew up kind of knowing some of the story or the folklore about the story.
Yes, and the house became the sort of local haunted house. So when the rest of the suburb started to become gentrified, you know, as all suburbs now seem to have done, that house was left and it was just sitting with this little hut on this quite large block of land, and it was always overgrown and squatters lived in there, and, you know, it was all sort of the local kids and make a game of it, and you had to run past it, you couldn't walk past it, and, you know, you had to throw something at it and try and break something, you know, it was all that sort of thing. And I can remember, firstly, as a child, feeling sorry for the house, because, you know, that whole concept of everything is alive to children. Everything is just like us. It has feelings. And I remember feeling very sorry for it. And then fast forward, this is a terrible story. I was in my late 20s, I think, and I was still living in the area. And I, because, you know, I've never gone very far in life, and I was on this particular Sunday brutally inebriated. I was hungover from something the night before. I don't know, I was absolutely rotten. And I'd gone to this arcade, which is across the street from the corner house, to get a hamburger or something to try and sober up. And I remember looking at the house again, and there was a sort of, it looked like there were squatters in it, and the house was just a wreck. You know, it was a wreck. And it looked haunted. And I still felt sorry for it in that strange sort of way. And then, look, I'm jumping all around here, but that house sort of never left me. And then fast forward many more years, and I'm not brutally inebriated in this anecdote, but I become a renter in my 50s, not having been a renter for decades, and being in this terrible position of having two special needs boys and no home and feeling like I was this massive failure and having to go and look at this house, you know, to rent as you do, and having 57,000 other people there as well. And this was 6 years ago. I mean, you can imagine what it's like now, and we had to find another place recently, as it was bad then, and just having an absolute, I just lost it. I lost it in the middle of this house. I had to run out. Because I think, you know, I just burst into tears, and this house just felt like this small hellscape to me, you know, like I can't live in this house. There was nothing wrong with the house. It was obviously just the whole sort of force of the situation just hit me. And so I attached all of that to this house, and I hated everything about it. And then actually the Sydney Writers Festival that you were referring to, I went to a session there with Tony Jordan and Paddy O'Reilly, and Paddy's book.
Oh, she wrote Other.
Yes, Other Houses had just come in, and I'd never read Paddy, and I had not heard of this book. And there was hardly anyone in this session, and I tell you, it was probably the best book talk I've ever been to. And Paddy was talking about all the years, of course, as a writer, being that she spent as a cleaner, you know. And she told this tale about how she would go into a house that she might have been cleaning for years, and she felt she knew the people and knew the house, and she would just walk in, and all of a sudden she'd get this bad feeling, this sad feeling, and she'd think, something's not right here now. And sure enough, a short time later, she'd be told her services were no longer required because the family was divorcing and selling the house, splitting up. And she said on stage, houses have emotion. And I remember thinking, because I was playing around with this idea of the house, thinking, you see, it's not just me. It's not just me. Patty thinks so too. So if I'm crazy, so is Patty. So I felt sort of great vindication then to sort of plow on with my nutty story about
her. Have you stepped foot in the corner house?
Never. I have sort of, you know, stalked it from the outside. And it's shown my son, who, of course, is interested in all things ghoulish like I am. Of course, the house has been, it's obviously been purchased and it has been improved, but to me, it still looks like.
It's interesting, yeah, because I wonder if certain neighbourhoods have houses like that. So growing up, I spent some time in the suburbs of Chicago, but there was this corner house. I wonder if it's always the house on the corner.
Yes, maybe.
My mom is not, you know, she's not a particularly superstitious person, but this house, it was like every family or group that moved in there, something bad would happen, you know, like there was a divorce, or I think there was, you know, a woman had a stillbirth there. And and she's, you know, that's the first time I started hearing about feng shui or, you know, the energy. But like my mom's take on it was that, you know, there was something about the energy of that block or that house. But I like that idea that houses have emotions, but also, yeah, the people who live in the house have so many emotions. And I also feel that came out a little bit in my writing too, that houses come to occupy us, you know, it's not always the other way.
Yes. And
houses come to reside.
Yes. One of the epigraphs I've got in the front of the manuscript is from Gaston Bachelard's Poetics of Space, and it's an entire past comes to dwell in a new house. And he believed in, and of course I think it's Jeanette Winterson who's written an entire collection of short stories based on what she believes. You know, she believes she's moved into a haunted house in London. So, you know, yeah, we're not, Patty and I aren't the only ones.
Genre. So in the book, the house is a character, I'm assuming.
And he is. There's a twist to that, but yeah, he is. And it's a he. He calls himself a we because he feels like he's a maisonette, so he's two. Nobody uses that term anymore, but
is that like a duplex?
It's like a duplex, yeah. But we used to call, or what my mother used to call, a maisonette. It was probably, nobody said that, but my mother would, you know, she was always deeply weird and said things her own way. But she used to call things a maisonette, and we had one up the road from us, and so the house believes he's a wee.
So what's your process like? What time of the day do you like to write? Where do you write?
I'm a write indoors because I'm a her indoors. So I write indoors. I'm a morning person. I have tried to be a night writer. Doesn't that sound exciting to be a night writer? I wish I could be.
Everyone's asleep and then I get up.
Well, I'm a darkness writer because I get up early when it's still dark. So, yeah, so I'm a darkness writer. Well, that's even better than a night writer. I'm a darkness writer. I've tried to be a night writer, but everything I write at night, absolute bollocks, and I end up hitting the delete key on. So, I've tried it. Done work for me. So up really early. My son doesn't sleep very well. So sometimes that can be a bit hard to get up at 5 when you're still up at 5. Like, you know, who needs sleep, eh? As I always joke, I'm only 29. See what it does to you. But, if I can, it's got to be as I was saying to someone the other day, I used to run, God, in another lifetime, but I used to run 8Ks every morning. And runners have got this ideology that if the rest of the day goes to hell, at least you've had the run, you know. And now I should run, but I can barely
run.
That's right. That's right. If I've done my, and I've got only a modest target of, 500 to 1,000. I mean, that's sensible given that I'm often unslept and not, lack of sleep is absolutely destroys the creative side of you. But if I've done my 500 to 1,000 words in the morning, then it doesn't matter what happens the rest of the day.
And so you're not in a formal writer's group that I'm aware of.
Hell no.
Unless it's a secret one that I'm not.
Hell no.
But what do you do after you have your finished draft? What are your next steps? Who have you shared book two with?
Well, the very lucky, and I say that tongue in cheek, Angela Slater normally gets to read my first drafts and gets the 5-page email of caveats and excuses for my lack of ability and my very existence. Angela's, of course, the very, very accomplished gothic fantasy folk horror writer and all-round scholar of all things writerly. So she normally gets to see my first draft. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Emily O'Grady, who was Fraser's recent sitter for his portrait in the Portrait Prize, she... we used to live near each other. Now, of course, we've moved to Timbuktu. But so she actually has read the manuscript of this latest one. So so maybe Emily. Sorry, Emily. She might be one of my first readers.
And Angela was your tutor, is that right, at the Australian Writers' Centre? Is that how you
two? No. In fact, the much maligned Twitter is how I just saw someone way back when I joined it, which is why I joined it in the first place, was to sort of, as an educative thing. I saw somebody post, Angela had just opened her books for, accepting people's stuff for assessments, and I had written my second short story, so the one after the one you accepted, and I'm a hopeless short story writer, and I don't think I'll ever bother again, but someone was just going on about how Angela was open for some spaces and how mother she was and how she'd made a great difference to her short story, which had gone on to win something. So I contacted Angela. Angela had a look at a sample of my writing, and so I sent my short story to her, and then that one made it into Overland.
Oh,
though she is a magician when it, because honestly, I'm not a short story. I'm not very good at them. So she helped me a very great deal with that. And then we've just moved on to, my novel manuscript since then. Yeah,
bigger and bigger things.
Yeah, much bigger.
I did want to talk about Fraser, your son, who is also an artist. So he is a painter, and he was recently hung in the Brisbane Portraiture Prize, which you mentioned. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful portrait of the writer Emily O'Grady. So what's life like in a house with two artists?
Well, you got to get lucky sometimes, Sarah. And I think I was really blessed. So I think it's, he's an enigma in that, Fraser is on the spectrum and has lots of things, and there are things that he won't ever be able to do, but that kid's artistic brain is just wild and so thrilling. And he's a very hard marker, to try and find a movie that he finds acceptable or a TV show or a book. He's got very high standards, very hard to please. So, we only watch the best and we only read the best. And so we're often, because television's such rubbish at the moment, we're sort of re-watching the greats and So re-watching The Leftovers and re-watching The Wire at the moment. And we sort of hunt down Tarkovsky movies on YouTube and stuff like that. And he's always trying to throw Mummy visual prompts. So he'll, you know, go through some art book or find some piece of art on the internet and he'll go, Mum, could you use this for some inspo? Could this be some inspo for you, Mum? And because he just wants me to write horror, I think really is his, which would be fine. I'd be happy to write horror if I could. And so, you know, we're sort of trying to give each other ideas. We have fantastic conversations when we're watching a film and all that kind of thing. And living with an artist is fantastically messy. So we have to, being renters, we have to be very careful. So there's sort of drop sheets everywhere and plastic tape to everything. But, you know, he always refers me back to Francis Bacon. Anyone who's ever seen a Francis Bacon documentary or his studio, you have to see it to believe it. I don't know how he got anything. It's mad. No doubt he knew where everything was, but it's piles upon piles of detritus or what looks like. But I'm sure he keeps saying, Mum, if you think I'm bad, you know, which he is, he's an angel. So it's terrific. We help each other, we support each other, and really it's a wonderful life.
You know? Yeah, I would love that. I love that idea that he sort of points in your direction some of those. Because in writing, you're often chasing really striking images that you can then write about or, you know, use words to create in the text. So I can imagine that would be quite powerful. But it reminds me of, I did a tour once of the Sydney Morning Herald, like the newspaper offices in Sydney, and, you know, it was all very open planned office and neat carpet and desk. And then you got to the corner where like the caricaturists were the artists for the newspaper. It was like paint stained everything.
Yes.
But no, obviously I'm lucky enough to have met Fraser. I mean, also very, you know, very charismatic young man. And I was just so excited for him to be acknowledged by that. Is he still, he does a lot of portraiture. Is that still his main?
Yes, that's his thing. Faces are his thing. And he's working on a self-portrait, which is huge and looks very interesting. And then he's actually going, his next subject, which he's hoping to enter in the Portrait Prize next year, it's actually an old mate of mine who's from my acting days, and he's a Brisbane musician, you know, back from the sort of Pig City era, you know, and who's got a spectacularly interesting face, just one of those unforgettable faces. So he's going to be doing him, so that should be fun.
And with Emily, did she sit for him live? Like, did she?
Yeah, she did. She came over a few times, and he sort of, you know, needed to get to know her, and just like he'll need to get to know my old friend Jared when he sits down to paint him. But he feels, because Jared was also a musician, and so he's able to listen to his music, you know, and sort of get a handle on things and watch, you know, they were on Rage and stuff. So watch the clips on Rage and stuff like that. But Emily came over and sat on my back deck at the old house, and we all talked, and he got to know her and he read her books. He was very, very thorough about, you know, getting to know her and her work and the sort of subjects that she covers. And like I said, he's just got a huge... He struggles to close a door, but he's, you know, he can sort of read these very high literary things.
There's a beautiful sort of delicacy in his portrayal of Emily, I thought, which meeting her as well. I like how that came through in the portrait. Well, we're nearly out of time, but I did want to finish with some book recommendations. So I'm very interested in what you're reading at the moment. And anything else that you've read recently that you need?
This is the good bit too, isn't it? So just quickly, the last few that I've just finished, The Echoes by Evie Wilde. God, loved that. Have you read that one? Yep. she is such a master of structure. Just, I mean, she showed that in The Bass Frog. But this, if you struggle with structure, as I definitely do, just read this. She tells such an enormous story in really quite a slim book, really. And she's got this after, before, then, and then a character's POV is the fourth sort of pillar in that. After, before, then, and the character POV. She sticks to that the whole way through. It is masterfully done. I think it's my favorite now. My favorite, I love The Bass Rock, but my favorite was probably All the Birds Singing. It's probably my favorite now from, because I've read all of her work. And Emily O'Grady recommended, after she read my current manuscript, she asked if I'd ever read Fiona McFarlane, and I hadn't. And she suggested Highway 13, sort of, it, you know, made her think of that, think it might be an interesting comparative title. And I don't normally read collections unless it's sort of written by someone I know. But it is, oh God, wonderful. I've never read Fiona before. Highway 13, she's got that kind of slightly experimental edge. And again, if we're looking at structure, there's two short stories, one called Fat Suit and one called Demolition. The structure is just sublime. She just unfurls those stories so fantastically.
When you talk about structure in your own writing, is it something that you're clear from the start, or do you kind of...
Oh, God, no.
...get myself away? Because I think structure is not my forte, and it's something I have to then go back and sort of impose upon the writing.
Absolutely. It's kind of like having... a net bag of jellyfish and trying to, you know, shove them all in. No, hopeless. Don't even. It just, no, very bad. I feel I always will be.
I think short stories, I think they're one of the hardest genres, because you really have to, we have to nail everything so quickly. But the ones that play with structure or have like this really clever arc with a twist. It's so informative to my own writing when I read a really strong short story.
And of course, me being the horror head that I am, if anybody out there wants to be absolutely scared stiff by an absolute banger of a horror book, Incidents Around the House by Josh Malerman. Oh my God, I haven't been so terrified since I read it decades ago. It's just an old, really old-fashioned horror about a demon who wants a kid. I got up in the night to close my cupboards because that's where the demon lives in the bar. I was so scared. I insisted on sleeping with the dog because I was so... Anyway, anyone likes a horror, that's the one.
Definitely not for me, but I will put it in the show notes.
Oh, good. It's
I'm wondering which of these are your before-you-go-to-bed cozy read.
Oh, that's my cozy. That's my, that's my bed book, definitely.
With Al at home reading about the demons.
I think, God, it's so good, let me tell you.
Well, I think we've come to the end. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, and I hope that you will be a friend of the podcast in the future and we can check in on you and see how you're going.
Definitely be a friend of your podcast, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And good luck. Well, yeah, I'll be putting together some show notes about all the things we discussed today. And, yeah, good luck on the query road for book two.
Thank you.
Best of luck with that one, and we'll check in with you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much.